This is...
Wow! What a week.
What a week. Politrix.
Welcome to Wow, What a Week, hashtag Politrix. Unlike others in the political arena, he won't use a sports team's win to announce his own news or further his agenda. We'd like to think we can also rely on him for some fair or even harsh commentary. Please give a wow welcome back to Botsang Modimowame Muilwa. Botsang, welcome back.
Good morning, Thato, and good morning to the followers, subscribers, and viewers.
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
I think let's start in the courts. There's a lot happening in the courts.
Yeah, we live in courts. You remember I said South Africa is gun and run by courts.
Ish. Which is not necessarily a good thing, right?
It's actually a bad thing. It means there's non-adherence to the law by both political office bearers and the citizens of this country. The fact that we spend time in courts, it means somebody somewhere is breaking the law and not adhering to the prescribed rules and regulations.
Yes, sir. What's happening with UNISA? Let's start there.
Yo. Why do you start with a rough one? And I'm very close to that one, you know. Let me tell you, coincidentally, when I was at UNISA in this past week,
yes, sir,
for the Thabo Mbeki School, you know, I've been busy with my exams and all those things. I met one of the professors there that I cannot mention. He's a personal friend, but we had a very lengthy discussion. And I asked that question, despite what I read in the media and on court papers, because I've been following the story. And to say, bro, what is happening in Utah? What is the true story? But after hearing him and looking at the court papers and the outcome of the court, I understood the story is about the money fresh. It's not about the administration of Utah. I'm not disrespecting or undermining the report of the administrator that was appointed, you know, who's also an academic. But if you look at that UNISA performance internationally on the rating of universities,
yes, sir,
has improved, you know, on the, you know, it's one of the best universities in the world, one of the top in distance learning, that's one. And it has improved in the last 4 or 5 years. Number two, the revenue, the current administration of UNISA in 2021, on record, the person who spoke to me said, They had about 5.7 billion, now it's 6 billion revenue reserves. In 2021, the current administration moved it from being 6 billion to 15.8 billion.
Jeez.
That's the revenue that reserves that UNISA have.
Jeez.
And that's where the battle is. It is the battle of the 16 billion plus minus that UNISA have in their coffers. And I asked, but what is it for? It's supposed to help students, bursaries. And remember, UNISA also operates on a big budget because they operate from all over the world. Even if the exams are written at embassies abroad or they've got foreign, they must still, it's dollar-based or foreign currency-based expenditure. But it's also running the university. The fuel, you know, this guy was telling me that the budget for the fuel in one financial year to run UNISA vehicles and to purchase vehicles and, you know, the whole transportation, it's over 1.5 billion.
Just the logistics.
Just the logistics. And you can see where the trouble is.
Yeah.
But the Minister of Higher Education, Dr. Bladen Zimande, as well, I do not know why did he rush to courts. If there was an investigation and a report compiled and the management of UNISA took the report on review, why rush to courts to set aside the review or implement your decision? What is the rush for?
I was going to say, because if, for instance, you decide that, okay, we're going to put you guys under administration and we are going to appeal that, why are you still sending your person in anyway?
Exactly.
It doesn't make sense.
It doesn't make sense because they were supposed to await the review process to take its course.
Absolutely.
Then it will come with recommendations or agree with the investigative report. But I think he rushed and I think the court came out very harsh on them. What I'm liking about courts these days is to put the cost on the wrongdoers.
Oh, yes.
Understand?
You're wasting everyone's time.
They're wasting the court's time. They're wasting the state resources in rushing to courts of law in order to do their job. And you ask yourself, why would the Ministry of Higher Education or the Department of Higher Education fight with an institution? Instead, they're supposed to be working harmoniously together in order for the benefits of the students of UNISA. But I've also picked up that the professors or the teachers' unions are involved into this whole process, whereby those representing the professors and the academics at UNISA, they are also impacted by this process because it's their livelihood, it's their salaries, it's their career, it's their future. Mm. But it is not a nice thing that is happening at UNISA. And I think the court decision to can put the brakes on the Minister of Higher Education is the right decision.
Absolutely.
I think they must let the process, don't rush the process. Take time. I was listening to Professor Senukwane yesterday, I think it was on Wednesday, when he was explaining on what are the challenges that they are faced with as academics and as their representative. And he was very clear to say, we want to cooperate with the minister, but we want it to follow natural and legal processes, not politicians involving. And fresh, we know, once politicians get involved, where there's billions and where there's academics, I don't say Dr. Nziman is not an academic, he's an academic himself, you know, he's well decorated. But once politicians get involved, those billions, they will disappear. We all know what will happen. And now I have an understanding that the battle for the soul of UNISA is the battle for money. It's not the battle that the UNISA is not doing well. How can UNISA be doing bad administratively when their finances has become better than the national finances? They're doing better than the treasury of the government. And their main focus of business is academic record and performance. And they're performing well. Are they performing bad?
And they've more than doubled...
More than doubled their revenue.
The revenue.
Exactly.
Yo. The IEC at the Concord, what's happening there?
Well, trouble in the IEC. Just 1 week after the IEC said we are ready to go, we clapped hands for them, we're waiting for the president to pronounce the date. The DA, this problem with the IEC, it's about foreign votes. That's the biggest problem.
Okay.
It goes back to what we spoke about. Why don't we have digital voting? Why can't they digitalize? Now, what is happening is, and I can talk with authority on this one. When I was stationed abroad, in every country that I was stationed in, whether Germany, Brazil, or Rwanda, the South African mission abroad, whether it's an embassy, consulate, or it becomes the voting station on behalf of the IEC. And it has been like that. I don't know why is it a problem at the moment, but having have listened to the deputy commissioner of the IEC as well as the DA, the biggest challenge is diplomatic missions are normally in capital cities. When they have consular services, they are in the big cities. For example, the USA has an embassy, obviously, which is in Tshwane, and then they will have consulates in Durban, Cape Town, and Joburg because of the commercialization and tourism and all that. Now, in countries that are vast, big countries, for example, if you look at Brazil, the capital of Brazil is Brasilia. The embassy is in Brasilia. But Brazil is four times the size of South Africa. Now, if you have voters who are a flight, four-hour flight to Fortaleza, which is a city in the north, you know, west of Brazil. To fly from Fortaleza to Brasilia to vote, it's a three-hour flight, four-hour flight. And they say those are the logistical problem because South Africans living abroad who are plus minus 2 million potential voters are having a problem in going.
So are they saying that logistically then South Africans abroad are disenfranchised if they can't vote online?
Because
not everyone can afford to travel 4 or 5 hours.
And also despite affording the affordability from the pocket, the inconvenience, the time, and you know, you go to vote, voting takes 1 minute. You understand? You know who you're going to vote for. But let me tell you that there are two challenges here. One is the DA. The Democratic Alliance has the biggest chunk since, for the last elections, for all the years since 1994, the biggest chunk of the now approximately 2 million potential voters abroad. Over 70%, if not 80, of those voters, they've been voting the DA. And so it's a
no surprises there.
No surprises there. All the guys who ran to Australia and they're still double passports, they will vote the DA. So the DA is pushing this hard, has been saying to the IEC, get your house in order or we are going to the Concord. The Constitutional Court has a problem as well because the way the Electoral Act is crafted and drafted at the moment, as it is now, it does not accommodate that electronic voting. Because if they accommodate it, if they do what they are intending to do, to allow those voters to go and vote electronically, just like we have an electronic registration system, they say they may look into that. You know what does it say? It's unjust and unfair for people in South Africa who will not be able to go and queue at the voting polls, even if they are there. There may be one reason or the other you may not be able to go there. We know transportation in rural areas.
Sure.
Even if the IEC, we know for all the years they will make means that the rural areas are covered. So that is the challenge that the IEC is faced with. I can tell you, between now and the proclamation of the elections, if they go to court on an urgent application, I don't think it will see the light.
Mm.
If they want to amend the Electoral Act, I think it will be more amended through a court, forced by the court order, than to go through parliament. So they are caught up in a situation.
What do you say to people who argue that, listen, if you're a South African who's traveled abroad on work, so you're on work for a couple of months, a year or two, yes, you should be allowed to vote.
Yep.
But if you've immigrated and you've been gone for 10 years, why should you determine what happens to us when you are there? What do you say to those people?
Fresh, one of the things that got me into trouble
as
a consular official abroad all the years
was,
why do I have to sit here, work overtime, and bloody accommodate people who have migrated?
They left.
They left the country. They are in Australia, they are in Germany, they are in the UK, in the US, as residents. They've got permanent residence permits. They live there. I'm not talking about South Africans.
And half of them even speak dirty of the country.
Exactly. Actually, the reason they left and they received resident permits, the main reason is because they felt unsafe in South Africa. They didn't want to be under the black government and things like that. Now we are sitting, I know the Bill of Rights and the Constitution, but somebody left South Africa in 1996 when the new constitution came into effect and went to settle down in Australia, the racist Australia that we spoke about last week against the Aborigines. That person has been living in Australia since 1996, but he still has the right to can vote and determine the government in South Africa. I think it's unjust for people who, as you explained,
if you're working,
people who for work, diplomats and people that are there temporarily, it is fully understandable why they should be given an opportunity to vote. But I am one of the people, and I've been very vocal about it, who are against people who acquired citizenship or residence of another country. Why should they determine how South Africans should live when they don't want to live here? And I think now it has come to caught up with them. I complained about this 20 years back. It has come to caught up with the IEC and the government to say, we created a monster. The monster is now biting us because we want to accommodate people who don't love this country, who decided to leave because they don't have confidence in this country. Now we are sitting and facing a constitutional court case or a parliamentary process because of the people who left this country. Call it justice. What justice is there when 62 million people are sitting in this country and some 2 million odd number are going to be part of the decision-making process to determine our livelihood. I don't think it's a just process.
I think our final court's story, Minister of Home Affairs, Dr. Aaron Motsoaledi, why is he losing court cases he ought not to lose? I am so confused.
Very close to my heart, one of my favorite ministers. But
same here.
Who is winning? Which minister is winning court cases in South Africa? Which one? Which minister is winning?
No,
the only thing they can do.
Yeah.
I'm sitting on a court case with my own, not the minister, but we report to the minister.
Yes.
It is with Minister Motsoaledi. Let me put it this way, fresh. I worked not for Home Affairs. I worked with Home Affairs for a number of years. When I served as a diplomat, one of my key roles was consular services, which is a Home Affairs function where they don't have a foreign representative. But in my most recent work in government, I served in the formation of the Border Management Authority for the last 7 years, from the formation in 2013 to the launch. I can tell you this thing, I saw it coming long ago. And sadly, I'm shocked and surprised like you. How come did the minister lose this case? It's on technical grounds, not on facts, not on the merit of the case. Number one, you will recall that the Minister of Home Affairs, Dr. Motsoaledi, only became the Minister of Home Affairs in 2019. And this amendment of the Immigration Act, and I think it's just a chapter, I think it's Section 31 or 34B of the Immigration Act that is under dispute and to be amended. One, the court had ruled and given Home Affairs from 2016 or 17 until 2 years to can adjust and amend or tweak that amendment to can suit the Constitution and the Bill of Rights and the law enforcement. The reason Home Affairs, and this is what people should understand, the reason Home Affairs at that time in 2018, they did not implement that parliamentary or court order and parliamentary process is because we went on elections. Now, automatically when we go on elections, it defeats or it erases what was in the pipeline because the new executives comes into effect, new parliamentary members. They must go back and start. But what happened that time is they failed to do that, to adhere to the court order and timeframes. That's why Minister lost. But subsequent to that and moving fast forward, Minister Motsoaledi took over. And what has come out now from court proceedings and from his own mouth is, one, his staff members, from top to bottom, from, and when I say top, I mean from the DG to the lowest ranking person in that department, none of them, not even one, briefed Minister Motsoaledi about that process that was put on hold.
Jeez.
Then ask yourself, why? Not one. You understand? Didn't brief him. So he caught up in a way, he caught up with it, tried to implement it, got the state attorneys, sometimes we refer to them as state law advisors, to can, you know, reactivate this matter. So what people should know is a parliamentary process or a bill to amend an act or a bill, it has two legs. One, it can be the executive one, where the minister takes this matter to parliament and deposit it or place it in front of parliament, then the parliament decides. The other one, it could be a process where parliament creates a new law or because of the court order or whatever dispute is there regarding this Immigration Act part. And in this instance, it was not an executive one. It was supposed to, remember, follow the parliamentary process. It did not. This whole 400 MPs kept quiet until the minister decided, I'm not going to sit on something that's not moving. He briefs the state attorneys. The state attorneys goes and appoint a senior counsels with a cost of, according to Minister Motsoaledi's words, 222,000 for this hearing. They lost the case with costs. So what has happened there is that the state attorneys, obviously, I assume they briefed. They were briefed by the department, executives, the DG, the DDGs, and everybody, lawmakers in the department. They briefed the attorneys. The attorneys will have to brief the senior counsel, the advocate, who can go and appear in front of the Supreme Court. The senior advocates, senior counsels, they did not even have a basic document of an affidavit signed by the executive authority, who is the minister, to can, you know, depose the affidavit and argue based on the underset. That's why the case was dismissed with costs.
Oh, wow.
But the court became very harsh. And look, I feel sorry for Minister Motsoaledi and the DG. However, courts are very tired, as we said at the beginning. Courts are very tired of what is happening. They don't see it that the minister was not briefed by his team or by the councils. No, no, they are saying, you are here, you are ill-prepared, you disregarded an order, they are doing things wrong, therefore you'll pay from your pocket. So Minister Motsoaledi, the DG of Home Affairs, they have to pay the legal costs from their own pockets. But remember the legal costs that I've mentioned of 222,000. It's only for the advocates. So there's attorney's fees, briefing fees, preparation of documents. We may be talking R1 million that must come out of their pockets here. But the other nice thing that the court came out, and I'm very happy for that. I'm happy with this court decision. I'm not happy with how Home Affairs is being held hostage by incompetent people or people who are failing to brief their principal. But I'm happy the court had said the advocates who failed to brief the minister and prepare the documents properly, they must not be paid. And where they are paid, the department or the government must recoup their money. So they must not get a cent. The court order was very clear. They must not get a cent of the money they've incurred. Look, we are very tired as a nation to be spending millions of rands on legal fees.
Yeah.
By incompetent public servants or by political office bearers, you know, whether it's ministers or DG or what, who are refusing and failing to adhere to the laws of the country. I'm not saying Minister Motsoaledi has failed to do that. I've explained how he unfortunately finds himself in this situation. But I'm glad the court ruled that the lawyers must not be paid. Let somebody pay from their pocket. I laughed on Wednesday night. People started a petition on on Twitter to say, can we start donating to Minister Motsoaledi? Because he's actually losing a battle for fighting for the nation of South Africa. But yeah, he said the heads are going to roll. He wants to go into the details. And I think it's betrayal. It's very worrisome. Look, I've been in the public service for years, but I will also be very worried if I'm a political office bearer and I found that my creme de la creme or creme of the crop in the department, the DG, the DDGs, the legal advisors, are not briefing me of the happenings in my department. You know what it will do now? It will start making Dr. Motsoaledi to start interfering with operational issues.
And he shouldn't.
You know, and he shouldn't. Mm. He shouldn't. Mm. But
he shouldn't have to.
He shouldn't have to. But in this instance, we will see Dr. Motsoaledi going now to talk to junior staff members in the department because the principals who are supposed to do that and brief him are not doing their job. And it's very worrisome for such an important government department.
Yes, sir. Let's go to the Office of the Public Protector. Former Public Protector is now in Parliament, and we have a brand new Public Protector.
Yes, congratulations to Koleka Taleka. I hope I've pronounced it correctly. Advocate Koleka Taleka, the Public Protector of the Republic of South Africa from the 1st of November. He started very well with the 1st of the month. Mm. You see, President Ramaphosa these days signs things very fast, doesn't keep things on the desk. But interestingly, a week ago, we discussed how the EFF appointed the former Public Protector Advocate Busiwe Mkhabane as a member of Parliament. Now look at the coincidences. The country announces the successor of Advocate Mkhwebane. The EFF that is running a parallel government, I think the EFF is running a parallel government more than the DA, the official opposition. They appoint the previous Public Protector to be a member of the Parliament, then subsequently a member of the Judicial Committee of Parliament. The committee that does what? That impeached her. The committee that appoints judges, the committee that is going to oversee
the Public Protector,
the Public Protector's office. So the previous Public Protector, Advocate Mkhwebane, is going to oversee on behalf of the EFF.
Yes.
Sitting next to Mr. Janji, the chairperson of that committee, who got him fired.
Yeah.
In the same committee to oversee that Advocate Taleka is performing her duties correctly and as prescribed. Very interesting development.
Is it a chess move? Is it a coincidence?
Look, I think it's not a coincidence. I think the EFF did a super chess move. Look, they are young, they are smart, they are educated. We know the noise they make in Parliament. They've got the facts. Even sometimes we don't agree with their conduct. But I think it's a grand chess move. It's checkmate. I call it checkmate in the judiciary. And we'll see how it unfolds. It's going to be a rough 7 years for the Public Protector. It's going to be seriously rough. But what I know personally of Advocate Busiwe Mkhwebane, she's a kind person. And people tend to underestimate kind people for being soft or weak. But she's a kind person. I don't think woman to woman, I think they can still work better. I don't think she will go there with grudges. When she started, people tried to create a grudge with the predecessor, Professor Madonsela. But they did not. You know, they had a lot of interviews together. They had their own differences. We are human beings. We can always differ on how we handle things. But I think the two of them will handle this professionally. But let me tell you, it's going to be rough 7 years for the Public Protector.
Let's stay in Parliament. Midterm budget speech. Minister Godongwani.
Yeah, well,
what are your thoughts?
He didn't have much to play around with. The country is in red, we know financially. We just loaned billions, you know, from the World Bank and the Monetary Fund. But look, it's austerity measures being put into place. Some people are arguing that, is it an austerity budget or austerity measures in government in general? I think it's just the austerity budget. Tighten your belt. I don't think the country or government is under austerity measures, because if the country was going to go into a total government austerity measures, would be cutting heavy government spending, would have considered cutting parliament, or not parliament, I mean the cabinet, as we were promised before. Yes, instead, sir, we increased it. So I think is the Minister of Finance, look, there was not much in that, but it's say tighten your belt, South Africans. The revenue collection has been good, but fresh, let me tell you something I learned this morning when I was coming to the studio. Do you know that we have almost 300 trillion that is owed to SARS? that SARS is supposed to collect, and majority of it is from businesses. Mm. 300 trillion rands, mm. that is owed to SARS. Look, SARS has been doing very well. They've been doing their job very well. They've been collecting very well.
They've been hitting the targets.
Yes, mm. and yes, but if we are sitting with 300 trillion there, it could be having, helping the minister of what do you call it, of the treasury. But again, if government talks of austerity measures and savings and all that, if that money or the savings were generated towards social development, education, health, and electricity crisis, then I will support it. But if that money is going to disappear mm. into the hands of politicians, into the campaign of elections next year, then we're having a serious problem. Structural developments, infrastructure development, those are things we should be looking at. But also the cut.
Mm.
South Africa is one of the most unsafe places on earth. And you go and you cut the security budget. Mm. It doesn't make sense to me. Mm. It doesn't make sense. We should focus on the fact that we must stop being a developing country. We must be an economy, a fully fledged economy, because we have the resources, we have the potential. The only problem I see now with South Africa is that we are now loaning. And instead of reducing our spending, mm. we are loaning money to cover our deficit, and I don't think it's a good economic move.
We should be punching at our weight. We're punching way below our weight.
Exactly. When you have, and it's simple economics, when mm. you have financial crisis in your life, and I know people will say a household is not equal to government. Yes, it's not. It can never be equal. But logic and economic sense says to me, if you've got financial strains, and you look at the add-ons, things mm. that you can cut, things that you don't need. For example, I'm going through financial constraints. I cut my wine consumption. Mm. And I say, you look at things that you can minimize, the foreign traveling, flying business class, cut the cabinet size, mm. fire the deputy ministers. You know how many billions we'll save when we... What is the duty of a deputy minister who's mm. not deputizing? Mm. First of all, South Africans don't know that deputy ministers are not members of the executive. That's why when one minister travels, another minister from another department acts, not the deputy. Exactly. So why are we keeping that position?
What's
ceremonial?
What's the point of having them?
And you know, all these big expenditures of government, I think they'll be forced to do that. Otherwise, we're getting more and more into red financial as a country. Mm. We can't live on loans, guys. During President Mbeki's time, at some stage, you know, and I don't know whether it was because of the work done from 94 to 1999, or whatever, but during that time, we managed to control our foreign debt and brought it almost to zero. And now we find ourselves loaning $563 billion from the World Bank and the IMF in order to survive as a country. And, you know, as Musi Maimane, I don't know what political party is leading now, says, you know, he's a pastor. I like what he says. The nation is going to pay for the sins of the politicians. And for one of the few occasions I agree with Musi Maimane, me and you, we're going to pay out of our pockets for wrong decisions that were made by politicians.
Sure. Now, one of President Bill Clinton's lasting gifts to Africa was AGOA.
Yes.
An opportunity for Africa, sub-Saharan Africa, to do business with America duty-free. You know, it's afforded South African businesses and African businesses, you know, an opportunity to do billions of dollars in business.
Yeah.
The AGOA summit literally just happened now in Johannesburg. Some nations have been told you're not part of the club anymore. Sorry for you.
Four of them.
Yeah, sorry for you. You're naughty people. You're not allowed anymore. What are your thoughts on AGOA?
Look, you number one, I think it was an imperialist tool used by the Americans to continue imperialism and the grip on the African market.
Mm.
That was one. China was growing and becoming bigger and becoming the number one economy in the world and trade partner with Africa. And America had to come with a plan. And remember this AGOA plan or act, whatever, it's a plan that was signed off or rubber stamped by Congress in the USA. So it's very important for the Americans. Yes, Africa benefited. And South Africa is one of the benefactors. We look at our products in the American market, our wines, even if they try to steal the rooibos, the BMW X3 that is, you know.
With thousands of products in the American market.
You know, millions. Mm. We benefit at a lot. Mm. But my only problem with the AGOA thing is America doesn't give it for economic performance only. They brought it in countries like now they are threatening one of the countries, four that have been named that you are being shown the door, is Niger. And we all know why in Niger. America needs the uranium from there and all that. But it's because of the position that Niger has taken against the West, particularly against France. And the USA says, you are not going to chase our soldiers out of your there. You are not going to fight with us the way you are doing with the French. If you do that, we'll chuck you out of AGOA. And actually, you must go now, or let's get into an argument and promise that you will behave from now. Now I have a problem with that. You are talking about economic trade between the two countries, or Africa and the USA. But when I misbehave in your terms, what you call misbehavior, you want to throw me out. I'm telling you, if Niger put a hard stance to the US is more likely to lose the money they are spending, because foreign aid is a problem on its own. The hand that feeds you controls you. Understand? So America will lose. They need that uranium and whatever now for their nuclear weapons, their arms, their cell phones, and all that. If they don't, Russia and China are standing next door and saying to Niger, we are ready to take over and to fund. But it's not only in Niger. It's also with our neighbor here, Lesotho. They are being threatened because they say the money they've been receiving as foreign aid through the AGOA program, they have not achieved the millennium plans that they said they will achieve. So they're also being threatened. But Lesotho has come up to say, we want to, improve. We have a new government, which is less than 2 years old, and we want to do that. But it's a problem. AGOA started in South Africa, coincidentally, on Thursday in Joburg, and it will end tomorrow on Sunday. And let's see who will be the surviving one. Remember the agreement. It's up to 2025.
Oh, it's about to expire. It's about to expire.
So these guys must go and satisfy the big brother to say, don't take food out of our mouth. We will behave or we'll perform better. I don't think South Africa performed better. I think, of course, we've been having a stable economy, but stable in a sense that there is regulations, there's rules and all that, but we have debts. So how do you measure the economy? AGOA, it's all about trade and economy. So how do you say South Africa can stay when they're more in debt, when AGOA was supposed to help us to get out of debt? So it doesn't make economic sense. That's why I'm saying it's an imperialist control and hold to the African market. But I don't think the U.S. will come out harsh, because I know they're being held hostage at the moment by the fact that China is having the hawks, claws, looking at opportunities in Africa. So thanks to China, Americans cannot withdraw from here, but they can take their military and leave.
Speaking of Lesotho and AGOA and governance, is there a crisis in Lesotho right now? What's happening, sir?
I think there's political crisis in Lesotho, and it's self-inflicted. But I actually call it self-inflicted because it's based on the problems of coalition and its selfishness of former ministers in the previous administration who were co-opted into or who went into coalition with the prime minister's party, Matekane. We would recall fresh, we covered the Matekane's victory on this platform, less than 2 years ago, or a few months ago, actually. Lesotho's administration is not even 2 years old. And the prime minister, who is an astute business person, a multi, millionaire, if not a billionaire, who came into power with 56 parliament seats. There's 120 seats in the Lesotho parliament. And you need 60 plus one, to can govern. So he had 56. You can already see that he had big numbers. But what transpired there is some guys or former ministers from various political parties who constituted the previous government from other parties decided to side with him. So he actually went into power as a prime minister of Lesotho with 65 seats of the 61 wanted. And 9 of those seats, they actually came from the opposition parties. And now what has happened is the remaining people of the opposition parties, because those who left them, they were not given cabinet posts. You see, he's a hardline stance person. He's a business person. He focused on the youth and he cut the cabinet size. He's fighting corruption and maladministration. He's putting Basotho first. Now, those who came to join him, they are not happy. because they never got cabinet positions. Ah. So they backtracked and they decided to betray him, if I may put it that way, or to betray the ruling party, to go back and form a coalition with the other parties. So they went for a motion of no confidence in the Prime Minister Matekane. Mm. And they even started pronouncing, as you know, recent as 2 weeks ago, to say who will be the minister of what, who will be the minister of what. So it's all about greed and power position. But a former professor at Wits, I think it's Professor Mahau, who was a professor at Wits, has a political party which has 7 seats. So when the betrayers or the traitors withdrew, the prof came and donated his 7 seats to the ruling party, to the Prime Minister Matekane, and he became even more victorious than the national elections. Now the vote of no confidence was defeated with 67 seats.
Oh, wow.
When he had initially 65. But the matter is in the Constitutional Court, because there's an argument between the two now that Professor Mahau will become the deputy prime minister when this whole circus ends. And then all the other guys will be fired. But again, it's putting Lesotho into crisis.
Yes, sir.
Because they are in a process of trying to convince the USA. As we said earlier on, their performance with AGOA, they didn't achieve their millennium goals. They didn't achieve what they promised AGOA. Now they are left with 2 years to, can, you know, turn that around so that it must be extended come 2025.
Yes,
and now they are having domestic problems. So I think as South Africans, we should pay attention of what is happening in Lesotho, because we may end up with a situation that once there's instability in the mountain kingdom of Lesotho, the influx of Basotho in South Africa and the challenges and us bailing them out, them going to SACU as a SACU member state or a SADC member state. So it is very crucial for us to actually focus and zoom into the happenings in Lesotho, the stability there, and the transformation of the government, because his government is mainly, it's a coalition government, but it's mainly for transformation. And his slogan has been Basotho people first, not political office bearers, which is something that I like, and I think thumbs up to the Prime Minister of Lesotho. And let's see how it goes, and let's hope that they will not be thrown, because it's one of the countries that were named by the US to say you didn't perform the way you promised. So once there's political instability,
you naughty child. I sometimes feel like we're in a playground and the big kid who has all the money and all the toys decides, you've been nice to me.
I'll grab my ball.
We'll play together.
Yeah.
I'm not picking you because it's my ball. Sometimes it feels like a playground.
It is.
And then others are treated like children more than others are.
Exactly. Like I said, South Africa has not been doing well economically. Yes, we are a stable country politically. But we are being left there. A tiny mountain kingdom like Lesotho, America wants to bulldoze it. No, man, they must leave Lesotho alone and deal with Russia and China and South Africa particularly. But yeah, let us pray for Basotho and let us hope for political stability. Now they've joined South African bandwagon. Courts. You understand? We are running
lawfare.
And this is where democracy becomes a problem.
Yeah.
But next week, when on our show, I want us to talk about the problem of democracy to Africa, as well as the so-called tiers of government. The three, in South Africa, we are talking about
three tiers of government.
The
yes.
judicial, the one. I want us to talk about it to demonstrate on that this democracy, which I call demon crazy, it was not designed properly to can suit African states.
Okay.
But we'll talk about it, you know, next week in detail, since we have covered most of the things that we wanted to cover today.
And that's the age-old argument. That sometimes you want to impose democracy on societies that might not need or want a democracy.
Absolutely. Majority, actually, of the countries in the world where democracy was imposed of them, they were doing better before democracy, which is imperialism in disguise. And now, look at Libya. Look at what happened in Libya. It's a classical example of how democracy that was imposed on the Libyans has dismally failed that country. But we should be wary of such. I don't have a problem with democracy if people prefer it in the majority, but it should not end up in voting only. We should make sure that it does not destabilize our cultural values. Our history must not just be wiped off because now we have to accommodate a democracy. I'm not in favor of that process.
Absolutely. In closing, Botsang, The Springboks are the world champions, rugby world champions, fourth time, second time in a row. But you have a different take on the Bok victory and the euphoria thereof.
Well, Fresh, as controversial as I would be, first, congratulations to the Bucks. And me and you last week, we said they will only win if they don't let New Zealand to lead.
Yeah, as long as they're not chasing.
They were not chasing and they became victorious with 1 point again. But look, this euphoria of the Bucks, and this is a political platform. This is where we unbundle the politics. The South African nation has been tricked by the Bokke slogan and noise. You were given no load shedding 2 days before the final. And everybody was smooth running and smiling and happy, no load shedding. And then they didn't even wait 2 more days after the game. Immediately after the game, you are back to load shedding. As Julius Malema said, what kind of a country are we running to go on load shedding when matric exam starts? And when there was a Rugby World Cup playing in France and people didn't go on load shedding, I don't even want to go into the SABC saga not being televised and the rights of Super Sport.
But some could argue that 8 p.m., how many people are drawing power at 8 p.m. on a Saturday?
Look, first, let's leave the load shedding part. But yeah. I'm telling you, this euphoria, I'm not in favor of it. The government has demonstrated over and over that load shedding is designed. It's true. Purposefully. There's a purpose to it. Even politicians like Julius says they will end load shedding in a week if they want to. Experts in energy have said load shedding can be ended in South Africa if the government was serious about it. We have seen it when there's a sports event, international events, sauna, what. We don't have load shedding. So it means we have the power and the control. Come with your scientific mind and say, yeah, but it's temporary. It's only for that time we can have a reserve. So if it's temporary, it means you can do it. That's my point. But looking at the Springboks, guys, by the way, I must confess, I lost last week in sport. Manchester United lost, Kaizer Chiefs lost, Barcelona lost, and All Blacks lost because I was rooting for All Blacks. You understand? Know. Yeah, and proudly so. I am not going to buy into the whole Springbok thing. I know it's sport. I must not politicize sports, but sports is politics. If you know the history of Springboks, one, it has been a white, lily white sport that never transformed. That's one. I'm not going to buy into the face that it is now led by Siya Kolisi, a black brother. No. That's not the issue. Look at the population demographics and look at the representation of people of color in the Springboks. That's not transformation, one. Two, the level of transformation goes to an element of prime schools in South Africa, because that's where the Boks are hunting.
Yeah, those are the feeder schools.
Yes, the feeder school that feeds the Boks. The prime schools that normal South African black child can't even get into that school. One, because of affordability. Two, because of the grades. So it is not based. Obviously, when I'm sitting at King Edward's Wat, and it's a Springbok feeder school, I'll have more better chance than somebody in Orlando West High. And that is reality that we must face. You know, we must not be afraid to talk about it. But let me give South African a little bit history of the Springboks background. The Springboks is part of the border bond creation. When the Afrikaners, the apartheid regime, wanted to say to the world, we are the best. The Afrikaners or the Boers in South Africa are the best. They are superior. They used the Springbok, actually. In the 60s or 70s, they went to an extent of the prime minister, Foster or whoever at that time, went to organize a game between the Springboks and New Zealand, coincidentally. Do you know what happened there? The Prime Minister of South Africa told the Prime Minister of New Zealand, the colony of England as well, to say, we are coming to play with you a friendly game, but we don't want any black person in your squad. And that's racism. Imagine, they had to dictate to them, despite the world protest. They were funded by the Stellenbosch. They continue to be owned and funded by the Stellenbosch. So this whole euphoria, I cannot downplay politics into it to say the Springboks have been used by politicians, by white capital, to can assert white supremacy in South Africa. And it's reality, it is the truth. Look at how the Springboks, during transformation, even when Mandela was there holding the trophy, they are the only sporting coach in South Africa, fellow South Africans, I don't know why the president in what we call it, the family meeting, does not address this. The Springboks are the only sporting code in South Africa that refused to change their colors, to change their emblem, and to transform. They literally refused. That's why they kept the Springbok emblem. They refused to adopt a national flower as an emblem. I don't have a problem with Springbok, the animal, but we have to tell the truth. We have to tell on how the rugby team of South Africa, which is a very good rugby team, I'm not questioning their performance and their winning, but we have to tell the truth on how it has been used historically to this day, and it's continued to be used as a tool to demonstrate white supremacy, on how white people are superior to blacks in South Africa. I'm not putting politics into the play and the game. They play very well. I like them. You know, people were a little bit surprised when I was sitting there, and every time people of color will hold the ball from any side, I will stand up and cheer and like, but you are racist. I'm not racist. I love black people 100%. And loving our people 100% does not make me, you know, racist. It simply says, I love black people, and there's no room to love other people. And that's not hate.
Yeah, black consciousness is not saying you hate other people.
No. I cannot
saying,
hate.
It's just saying you are so self-aware.
Exactly. Mm. And people must know the truth. If people are going to hate me and catch me now and criticize this show that I was not supporting the Springboks, I have a democratic right not to.
Yeah.
I wanted the All Blacks to win so that rugby in South Africa must transform from the boardroom through the coaching line and to the number of players. You can't tell me that less than 10 million white people in South Africa produce best players against almost 50 million South Africans who are people of color. How many Indian people are in the box? You want to tell me there's not one Indian person who can play rugby in this country? The so-called Indians, one in the whole rugby squad. Come on, guys, we have to be realistic. But anyway, congratulations to the Springboks. On Thursday, they were in Tshwane. You know, there was all the hullabaloo there. They are world champions. But we have to go back to the history. We have to tell the truth. You know, they say if you have a boil or see, so you must open that up and take out this thing of us polishing things and putting makeup and sugarcoating things, it will catch up with us.
Sure.
It will. But congratulations to the box. Anyway, for me, it's political. If the Afrikanerdom and the Broederbond used sport as one of the tools to enshrine racism and white superiority, then we should dismantle that. And like we did in soccer. If you look at the representation of soccer, Bafana Bafana and all that, you can see the population demographics representation. Somebody may say that's why they're performing so badly.
But also soccer was never exclusive like that.
It was not. It was never.
So even in the 80s, you still had white players that wanted to play.
Yes.
They were able to play.
We have the Dundee Uniteds and many teams in the 70s and 80s that were so-called white teams, Acadia Shepherds and so forth. So it was never that. It was never used as a tool. But the two major, in inverted commas, sporting codes, rugby and cricket, we need to transform that.
On that note, Botsang, thank you for your insights, as always.
Thanks, my brother. Thanks to the viewers.
Where do we find you online, sir?
BotsangM@gmail.com. And you can also WhatsApp me on 082-485-9100. And on all social media handles, at BotsangM. By the way, there's been a request. I've been following. I didn't answer. And those who have been requested to say, no, we are in the election era. You guys must start having guests and so forth so that we can... What did the person write? One of the followers said we
decide
can...
Decide who to vote for.
Yeah, no. They say so that we can expose them and we can trick them to come and tell the truth. Yeah. But I said to some of the people, look, some are calling me. We can look into that going in. But I didn't want this platform to be common and normal political platform like other media houses, whereby you have leaders of political parties coming to sit here and continue to use this platform to mislead like they're doing with other platforms, the people. Our duty is to educate, to tell the truth, especially the uncomfortable truth. But it's more of public administration and government services than of politics. They are tricking the people. We are trying to help them.
on the Polytricks platform. Thanks, Father Fresh.
Ladies and gentlemen, hashtag Polytricks with Botsang Mwilwa. Wow, what a week from Amped Studios, downtown Johannesburg. We're part of the Africa Podcast Network. Shout out to Pezulu Works for the cinematography, Trevor and his crew always representing. Otis the Flo Fraser for all of the imaging that you hear on the show. Our guest, Botsang Modimoame Mwilwa, our creative producer, Kuvesh Mohan, and our show producer, Keletso Modisa King. Email us at waw@africapodcastnetwork.com. Till next week, have a great political week, in spite of yourselves.